Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world. With host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. While Syria's more than eight-year-old civil war grinds on, the countries flanking it to the east and west are undergoing their own convulsions, with massive protests rippling across Lebanon and Iraq. Their grievances specific to each country, but also some key similarities shared by the protests. To help break all of that down, we're rejoined by Randa Sleem, Senior Fellow and Director of Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program at the Middle East Institute. Randa, it's good to have you back on The Crisis Next Door.
Thank you very much, Jason. Good to be back.
The protests in Iraq and Lebanon erupted earlier this month, and already they've claimed one prime minister, with Lebanon's Saad Hariri handing in his resignation to President Michel Aoun after saying he hit a dead end amid the protests. Lebanese protesters are calling for the overthrow of the political class that's dominated the country since the end of the country's long civil war in 1990. Randa, before we get into Hariri's resignation specifically, let's set the table. What sparked these protests in Lebanon and Iraq?
In Lebanon, what sparked the protest is a decision by the Minister of Communication to impose a tax on WhatsApp. And Lebanese rely on social media and WhatsApp a lot. But this was just the tipping point months and years of frustration that the Lebanese have had against the government inability to provide basic services, electricity, healthcare, clean water, against the corruption which has been now endemic and institutionalized at all level of governments, from the national level to the regional level to the local level, at nepotism, at what they felt is this increasing gap between the super wealthy and the rest of the population, the middle class, which has always been a strong and large segment of the Lebanese population, is really getting decimated over the last few years because of all the taxes that the government has been imposing, and because also of economic policies that have not created jobs, that have led to theft of public funds, because of corruption, because of nepotism. And so this tax that has been imposed on WhatsApp was just the last throw, basically, for the Lebanese, and this protest wave is not like something new. I mean, we have had smaller scale protests now for the last few years, going here and there, against the deteriorating economic conditions. And we have had in 2015 another protest wave when, at the time, the government could not deal and still does not deal with the garbage, and we call it the garbage crisis. And so this has been an ongoing frustration and over time, a realization by the people in Lebanon that the political system, which has been in place, as you said, since the end of the civil war in 1989, 1990, is no longer serving them, is no longer there to protect them or to serve their interests. And by the way, it's the same feeling now driving the protesters in Iraq. The rules of the game that were put in place with the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, brought together few political elites who worked with the Americans to design the new political system, which is, again, like Lebanon, very much based on power sharing, based on, dividing the pie between different political parties defined by their sectarian identities. And so, again, the Iraqis have, especially the youth, have decided that this political system, which has been in place since 2003, which despite the billions of dollars that Iraq has collected from the sale of its oil over, the past years, did not improve their life. I mean, they still have no, in Basra, where the majority of Iraqi oil is exported from, people don't have even, clean water. Electricity is not regular. You don't have regular services of electricity throughout Iraq. There are safety issues, jobs, lack of jobs. You have, millions of youth who are sitting there without jobs, graduate students. One of the protests, in fact, that really pushed the people to go into the street en masse, even before October, was a protest by university graduate students who were in the streets outside government offices protesting for lack of jobs. And then they were met with water cannons. And there is this iconic picture of a woman of women university students being running away from these water cannons, and that really angered a lot of Iraqis and created this perception among large segments of Iraqis that this government is out there for itself. These political parties are out there to promote their own interests and their own patronage networks, and they are not there to serve their interests as citizens.
It's interesting how both the protest in Lebanon and Iraq really started over pocketbook issues. We've seen this elsewhere in the world, Chile, for example, but have now broadened to cover the power-sharing structures in both of those countries. Do you think that the average Lebanese or Iraqi would be okay with those power-sharing structures if the economies in both countries would be better than what they are right now?
Look, I think power-sharing structures, at least in Iraq, have been there now since 2005. I mean, even 2004, when the interim council, governing council, was put together on the basis of sectarian quotas, and then you had the constitution formed in 2000, voted on in 2005. In Lebanon, power sharing based on sectarian, quotas have been there since the founding almost of the country. And it has been reinforced by the Taif Agreement, which was signed by all political parties to bring the civil war, 15-year civil war between 1975 and 1989 to an end. So how much is the system itself that is being rebelled against? I mean, the way it is. I mean, is it because people have abandoned sectarian identities and want now issue-driven politics and political parties that are defined by their political platforms and not necessarily by which sect or which group or confessional group they represent? Or is it the economy that has brought to the forth this debate about whether the system, which is based on sectarian power sharing, has served their interests? It's hard to tell. I mean, if the economy was better, people would not be in the streets. Maybe, yes, it's likely. But the fact you have this convergence now of deteriorating economic conditions and a system that has failed to deliver on these, pocketbook issues, on these basic needs of the people, then has put into question the kind of political system that is in place, which in both instances happen to be based on sectarian power sharing.
And speaking of sectarian power sharing, Hezbollah has been a key member of Hariri's coalition government, and the Shia group has not been happy with the protests, saying that Hariri's departure would leave a void in Lebanon's government. We've seen a number of Hezbollah supporters attacking some of the protesters. How big of a void is Hariri's resignation, and how will that upset the government in Lebanon right now?
Look, there is a governing coalition which has been put in place based on an understanding between these three major political stakeholders in Lebanon. The Aoun, the Free Patriotic Movement led by the President Aoun and his son-in-law, Gibran Bassir. Then you have Hezbollah, led by its Secretary General, Hassan Nasrallah. And then you have the Future Movement, led by Hariri. And this is the political coalition, in a way, which has been now in leading the government for the last 9 months or so. And it took them a while to get to form a cabinet, and to form a government. To form the cabinet in the past. And so the resignation of Hariri, basically, or what Hariri has done, is decided to put himself on the sidelines of this coalition. He is not viewed by the protesters as, you know, as one of them. He is viewed as part of this regime or this political system against which they are rebelling. So what he's doing now is, on one hand, put himself on the sidelines, not totally outside the governing coalition. And in fact, now that the president of the president of the republic has to conduct, but according to the constitution, he has to conduct parliamentary consultations about who, what the parliamentarians say in terms of their preferences for the next prime minister. And on the basis of this consultation, he's going to nominate a new person to head the next cabinet. And given the power balance in the parliament, I mean, it's very likely that Hariri might be re-asked or retasked by the president on the basis of the parliamentary consultation to form the next cabinet. Now, recently, today, in fact, the president said, well, it's going to be a clean government. He did not say it's going to be a different government. He said we will try to include technocratic, faces in it. I don't know how, what kind of prime minister would be acceptable to the protesters. Now, when the protesters were asked, okay, who are your nominees for prime minister? Who are your nominees for minister in the next cabinet? Some of the leaders, although this is a protest movement that are leaderless, that remains leaderless, but some of the leading voices in the protest movement are saying, you know, it's not up to us to give you names, you government to give you names. It's up to our responsibility as protesters is for us to review whatever names you propose for prime minister or for the cabinet, and to decide whether these are acceptable to us on the basis of their skills, of professionalism, non-partisanship. And so I think this next step of nominating a prime minister and of forming the cabinet is not going to be an easy task, again, because we still don't have a dialogue going between the protesters and the government. And the protesters today feel that, you know, they feel emboldened because their number one demand, which is the resignation of the prime minister and his cabinet, has been fulfilled. Their next demand is this formation of the technocratic cabinet. Who is going to populate this technocratic cabinet? This is where the next tug of war and push and pull between the government or the governing coalition on one hand and the protesters will happen.
Lebanon's interior minister says the resignation of Hariri was necessary to stop the slide into civil conflict. And then Hezbollah leader Nasrallah accused foreign powers of funding the protests, trying to pull Lebanon towards a civil war. How big of a fear is it in Lebanon that there could be a repeat of what happened from 1975 to 1990?
You know what? I mean, it's always there because once you have large numbers of people in the street, once you have thugs like we have seen, you know, yesterday coming in, trying to create trouble, to open roads by force, attacking protesters, you know, I mean, it can happen. But I have to say that the Lebanese army, the Lebanese riot police, police in general, security services have really performed very well in protecting the right of the protesters to peaceful demonstrations, in intervening professionally when you have this altercation between the protesters and those who are opposed to them, like we have seen yesterday. And so far they seem to be able to control the situation. And also, as it's always in Lebanon, the political stakeholders, the major political stakeholders in government, seem not to want to drag this into a violent confrontation between the protesters and those and their supporters, you know, because after all, we have 1.2 million, whatever, in the street, but Lebanon is 4.5 million citizens. And so you have also at least an equal number of people who are not in the streets. Some of them are supporters of Aoun, some of them are supporters of Hezbollah, some of them are supporters of Birre, some of them are supporters of Jumblat, and some of them are just afraid, are hedging. They are not willing to totally go into the protest movement because they don't think that these protesters can deliver, you know, at the end, that as happened in 2015, you have protests, and then in the end, the political system will win, and nothing changes. So you have now really a division inside, you know, among the Lebanese. You have a large numbers who are protesters. Their demands are shared by everybody in Lebanon. So irrespective of whether you are a Hezbollah supporter or a Aoun supporter, you are suffering from lack of jobs. You are suffering from lack of, you know, regular electricity transmission. You are suffering from pollution, you know. You are suffering from corruption and nepotism. So what drives the protests, you know, the million and some who are in the street, are shared. Those drivers are shared by everybody in Lebanon. Now, Lebanese differ on how best to, you know, address these demands. You know, some believe that this sustained protest movement is the way to go. Others believe that, you know, maybe we need to see if a new government, you know, is formed and then give space for this new government to get its job. So this is where things are. I think it's going to be, there will be attempts, and they have already started, of delegitimizing the protest. Attempts by Hezbollah, attempts even by, as recently as a few days ago, by a minister who is part of Hariri's parliamentary bloc, by Aounis, you know, supporters or officials who are affiliated with President Aoun's movement, of saying, oh, these protesters are funded by foreign embassy, they are there to fulfill foreign agendas. So Hezbollah said part of the movement is funded by the Saudis, the Israelis, the Americans, as part of the latest push or the latest installment of the U.S. Anti-Iran maximum pressure strategy. And today, the spokesperson of the Iranian president said exactly that, said that these protests are being funded and pushed by the Americans, the Saudis, and the Israelis, and that... you know, they are these external powers are trying to ride the wave of this protest movement. Not mentioning that Iran has been funding for years now Hezbollah in Lebanon and recently the PMF in Iraq.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about the protests in Iraq and Lebanon with Randa Sleem, Senior Fellow and Director of Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program at the Middle East Institute. You mentioned the performance of the security forces in Lebanon, despite some violent interactions. Nothing like what we've seen in Iraq, where the death toll is already in the hundreds and the violence seems to be growing by the day. Why do you think there's such a stark difference in Iraq compared to Lebanon?
I think partly is, I have to say that since the end of the civil war, there has been a lot of work and funding, especially by external, by donor countries, and training led by donor countries, focused on the Lebanese army, focused on the riot police, on the, you know, security services in terms of, you know, civil-military relations, community policing, in terms of how to deal with riots, you know, while protecting protesters of rights, protesters' right to civil demonstrations. On one hand, that is a factor that has really influenced over the years, that has created this mindset within the security establishment and military establishment in Lebanon of how the military and the police should engage with protesters. So that's one. I think there is also a long tradition of the army of trying to play a fair arbiter role when you have power contestation in the streets between different groups of Lebanese. And I think the current general leading the army feels that that's the role that the army has been playing. You know, the army also, the Lebanese army, relies heavily on funding and assistance from the United States. And I think the United States has been now clearly, publicly, and through back channel, sending clear messages to the leadership of the Lebanese army of the importance of, you know, being there to protect the rights of protesters to peaceful demonstration. So that's one. The second, I think, it's the maturity of the Lebanese civil society. Again, like the army, there is a lot of work that Lebanese have done with the help of outside donor agencies, outside expertise from civil society, in different countries that have gone through civil war. Since the end of the civil war, there has been a lot of work done on civil society, on nonviolence practices, on lessons learned, you know, from other instances where you had protest movement, on citizenship education. And I think that has created certain level of professionalism and political maturity in Lebanese civil society, but in Lebanese population a bit large. I mean, Lebanon, with all its political colors and all political groupings, with all its, you know, divides, sectarian and otherwise, really, you know, value, for example, the right of others, you know, to discuss right of different others. I mean, if anybody who looks on a daily basis, as I do, at Lebanese media, I'm always, you know, impressed by the quality and the openness of discussion on Lebanese media. And you flip the TV and you look at, for example, Egyptian TV, or you look at Syrian TV, or you look at even, you know, any TV in Gulf countries. None of this openness and willingness to debate and understand views of different others without, you know, degenerating into name calling or accusing them of being traitors or any of this. I mean, all of this, so both the Lebanese street, the Lebanese people, the Lebanese civil society, and the Lebanese army, the Lebanese forces, really have, in a way, have been developing over since the end of the civil war, and they have taken the right lessons from the civil war. They have been working within their own respective spheres of operation on how to promote debate, how to promote interactions with people who do not share each other's opinion without resorting to violence, and rather resorting to laws, rule of law, to resorting to public debates.
Sectarian violence, obviously a lot more recent in Iraq's history. Is that specter of a conflict growing between the Shiite majority and the Sunni minority in Iraq?
No, I think the fear in Iraq is Shia on Shia civil war, is a, you know, that we are seeing today, you know, between, for example, Muqtada Sadr groups and PMF, who are funded by Iran. I think sectarian violence, as we have seen 2005, 2006, 2007, Sunni Shia, I think this violence has dissipated. And again, what the protests in Iraq today are shared by everybody in Iraq. And the reason that you don't see, you know, Sunni majorities areas going into the protest or protesting is because they are still afraid that if they were to go into the street en masse, they will be accused by the, you know, people in power as being ISIS affiliates or ISIS followers. There is this still the stigma of any kind of collective action by Sunni, especially in areas where it used to be ISIS strongholds, you know, before ISIS was defeated and kicked out of those. There is a stigma, and people fear that. So it's a kind of self-censorship. But if you look at social media, at Facebook postings from people in Mosul, in other, you know, Sunni-majority areas, even from people in the KRG, in the Kurdish regional government, you see, you know, people very much endorsing, supporting the protests, which, as I said, happened mostly they are happening in Baghdad, which is a mixed city, but also where the protesters are in their majority Iraqi Shia. And I think Iraqi Shia, more than Sunni or more than Kurds, feel that, you know, it is their duty, their role to reject the system, which is pretty much, you know, Shia controlled. And so I think having Iraqi Shia youth in the street saying no to a political system which is supposedly designed to benefit Shia is in fact a much more powerful indictment of the failure of the system.
Do you see Iraqi Prime Minister Abdul Mahdi following Hariri's lead and resigning his position, and would it matter if he did?
Look, I think I have predicted for some time, since the first wave of the protest, early October, that it's going to be difficult for Adel Abdel Mahdi to stay in power. It's going to be difficult. I think Yesterday, we have seen, you know, war of words and public messaging between Adel Abdel Mahdi, Hadi Al-Amiri, and Sadr. Basically, Adel Abdel Mahdi sending an 800-word letter to Sadr saying, well, you have been calling for my resignation. Well, if you want my resignation, you and Hadi Al-Amiri, who control each the two largest parliamentary blocks, go to the parliament and get a vote of no confidence going and force me to resign. I mean, that's the legal way. I came through based on an understanding between the two of you, you know, and now if the two of you agree on kicking me out and vote, you know, force a vote of no confidence in the parliament, I will go. And so, and I think Adel Abdel Mahdi said that partly because he knows that even though Sadr and Hadi Al-Amiri have the two largest parliamentary blocks in they just don't have enough votes to force a vote of resignation, which requires 165 votes in the Iraqi parliament. Between the two of them, they don't have 165. Now they will need the, you know, Kurds, the Kurdish vote. I mean, they need the parliamentarians, Kurdish parliamentarians to vote with them for in a vote of no confidence. And right now, as far as the KRG leadership is concerned, Adel Abdel Mahdi is really they like this prime minister. They like him. They think he's the best prime minister they're going to have, who is attuned to their and willing to work with them in meeting their interests in safeguarding, you know, especially when it comes to their part of the budget, the revenue sharing. You know, already there has been a dialogue going on between the KRG and between Erbil and Baghdad on issues that lie at the core of the dispute between Erbil and Baghdad, which is revenue sharing, you know, and the disputed territories. So they feel that there is a process in place. Adel Abdel Mahdi is sympathetic to their concerns. And so if Adel Abdel Mahdi were to be removed, none of the typical, you know, faces who are out there who can replace Adel Mahdi will be as sympathetic and as constructive in dealing with them. And so I think the person who can really, as has happened in the past, who can really force Adel Abdel Mahdi to resign is Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani. I mean, we have seen him in the past. He doesn't intervene directly in the retail politic arena, if we can put it this way, except when he feels that the political order is in jeopardy. And we have seen him in 2014 after ISIS took over Mosul, basically coming in and withdrawing support for Maliki. And even though Maliki won elections and was there, based on elections, he basically, you know, said it's time to have a different person in government. And so I think until now, Grand Ayatollah Sistani have not done that. You know, he has called on the protesters to, you know, not to resort to violence. He has called on the government to protect the, you know, protesters' rights. He called for committees to investigate the violence that was perpetrated early in October, and the committee gave really a report that was anything but credible, since it did not even, you know, address the issue of the masked, unidentified, you know, snipers who basically killed a lot of the protesters early in October and who are, you know, viewed by most Iraqi officials as being affiliated with Iran-funded militias, Iran-funded Iraqi militias. And so the investigative committee did not even mention laid the blame on the violence perpetrated earlier in October on the security commanders, and really did not address the issue of these snipers. And that basically, again, was another evidence or another proof for the protesters that this government is not credible and is not going to really be serious about addressing, or is not serious and is not able to address their concerns. And so we are waiting now for Grand Ayatollah's sermon tomorrow on Friday. I mean, tomorrow is Thursday. So Friday, everybody is awaiting that sermon. Right today, there were meetings between the three presidencies, the president, the speaker of the parliament, and the prime minister, to find a pathway out of this. Political parties are also meeting. Leaders of political blocs are meeting to see if they can find a way out of this. I think it will be interesting to see what will be Grand Ayatollah's stance, you know, through the Friday sermon that his representative will give on Friday. If he moves toward basically pulling the cover away from from Adel Abdelmahdi or denying his support anymore, calling for some change in government, although he does it indirectly, not says it like this directly, I think then the days of Adel Abdelmahdi in government are numbered.
Randa, to wrap it up, what are your respective confidence levels in peaceful resolutions to the protests in Lebanon and Iraq?
Look, in Lebanon, I think there is a pathway to a peaceful resolution. There are legal mechanisms which everybody seems to agree that they have to be followed to get to the demands that are formulated by the protesters. I don't see major opposition in the governing coalition to getting to a technocratic cabinet, a new electoral law. And by the way, a new electoral law, no matter how it is designed, even if it's different from whatever exists today, benefits Hezbollah. It doesn't matter. Yani, they are not going to be heard by it. So they are not going to oppose it. In fact, it's in their interest to, you know, in fact, endorse this new electoral law. In fact, I see other groups, other political parties that are today not in the government and that are supporting the protesters who will be harmed by a new electoral law that is not based on sectarian apportionment of the parliamentary seats. So there is a pathway. It might take some time. You know, in Lebanon, nothing gets done easily. So it's going to take some time to get there. The fear is that hopefully violence will not creep in this interim period until the Lebanese can find them, you know, find their way to a compromise. Eventually, it's going to be a compromise. But it's going to be better than what we have today. It's going to lead to, you know, I think because everybody in power, be it the people in government or the other political parties, have realized that the days pre-October 16 are no longer, they cannot go back to the status quo ante, that the business as usual is not going to cut it anymore, and that going forward it has to be different ways of conducting government. There will be accountability, that there is a street that is motivated, mobilized. The problem is that, again, the protesters need to be able to form some kind of a leadership in order to be able to contest this political space. So far, they have not done so. Hopefully, this is something that's going to evolve, and that's why it's going to take some time. You know, you have a government on one hand, but then on the other hand, you have a protest movement representing millions of Lebanese, million and some of Lebanese, but it's still leaderless. And to be able to contest the political space in the future when there are early elections, to be able to enter and contest this early election and bring new faces into the power, into the political equation, in parliament, in government, they need to be organized and need to have a political machinery. And I think that's going to take some time for change, real change, to start happening. And hopefully no violence will happen in the interim. Iraq, it's difficult. I think Iraq, the protest movement is not as mature and as disciplined as it is the case in Lebanon. I think in Iraq, you don't have the same kind of realization among the political elites that change is inevitable. You are going to see a lot of resistance from the political elites. They have lots of resources at their disposal, unlike Lebanon, which is really cash-strapped and poor. I mean, you have major oil resources in Iraq, which can be deployed by different political parties to be able to, you know, sustain any kind of opposition to the protest. You still, as I said, don't have all of Iraq protesting. You still have a segment of Iraq. You know, I hate to speak in sectarian terms, but mostly it's Shia who are protesting. You know, it's important for this protest to really make major strides forward is that it starts to widen and include all of Iraqi territories and not only Baghdad and southern regions. And then you have also Iran. Iran is going to play a much, much heavier role in preventing any change upending to the status quo in Iraq, primarily because the kind of threat that Iraq represents to Iran and has represented historically is different from, you know, Lebanon. I mean, Lebanon does not share borders with Iraq. Lebanon did not fight eight-year war with Iraq. Lebanon did not have a, you know, long-term enmity to Iran, even under the Shah and then after the Iranian Revolution. So in Iraq, the equities and the threats that any change to the status quo in Iraq will face Iran with is means that Iran will be much more heavily involved in preventing the kind of compromise change in the status quo that the protesters are demanding. So I think Iraq is a little bit more difficult, and as you have said, the violence we have seen to date is really, you know, it's really shocking. So, you know, Muqtada Sadr said that he is looking at one of two possible scenarios for Iraq going forward if Adel Abdel Mahdi does not resign quickly. And he said it's going to be either like Syria or Yemen, which is a not nice scenario to look at right now. It's going to be a much difficult road ahead for Iraq than, in my opinion, for Lebanon.
Yeah, and the Middle East certainly does not need another battleground like Syria or Yemen. Hopefully peaceful resolutions in both Iraq and Lebanon. Randa, thank you once again for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
Pleasure to be with you, Jason. Thank you.
We've been joined by Randa Sleem, Senior Fellow and Director of Conflict Resolution and Track 2 Dialogues Program at the Middle East Institute. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.